All right, if you have your Bibles, if you'll turn to Deuteronomy. All right, Deuteronomy. We're going to pick up where we left off last time, Deuteronomy chapter 8. If you don't have a Bible with you, we do have some in a bookcase back there. Kimberly's by them right now. She can wave at you if you need one. And I don't know what that was about, but and I won't even tell you who that was. We are here in Deuteronomy as Moses is giving the instructions. Remember, Deuteronomy, Deutero means the second telling of the law. And it's Moses is reiterating to the Israelites where it is that they came from, what it is that God was expecting of them, and they're ready to take the promised land. They're ready to go into the promised land. So this is Deuteronomy, remember, is just made up of a big, huge church service. I mean, Moses preaches three sermons, and then they sing a song, and he gives a blessing to the people, and then he goes and dies. And it all makes sense, really. So this is Moses being long-winded, and something I relate to. And so he has so far been going over the warnings to them about the things that they're going to be encountering as they come to the promised land. Before that, he was going over the law, different aspects of the law in terms of the Ten Commandments, reminding them of what God was expecting of them that way. And then he's been warning them about the things that they'll be facing, but encouraging them to have faith, have confidence. It's all going to be all right. So that's where we left off last time. Remember, he was going over the blessings that was going to that would overtake them if they would be obedient to him and they would listen to him and they'd do everything that he tells them to do. And so now we pick up here in chapter 8, and he continues on in this. So chapter 8, verse 1, Moses is still talking. He says, "Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." Real quick, I want to stop here and make a note of this. Look, right off, you know, God is reminding them. He does want obedience from them. He does want them to obey. There's a reason for why he's giving them this law. There's a purpose behind it. He's setting the stage for the great rescue plan when Jesus comes on the scene and fulfills all of these things. But remember how he allowed them to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. They disobeyed the Lord. They rebelled against him. And at one point, finally, God just said, "That's it. I've had it. You're not going to go into the promised land. That generation's going to go off. And for 40 years, you'll wander in the second generation, the ones that you were afraid of, your children. You were afraid for them, saying the giants will kill them all. They're the ones that are going to go in and take the promised land." And so for 40 years, they wandered around. And they weren't able to go in. But here we see that God was doing this for a reason. He says right in there, he says, "I was doing that to humble you." Well, so that tells us something about Israel at that point. There was a level of pride there, an expectation that, well, you know, we're God's people. We've gotten away with it this far, so I'm sure he'll get us off the hook again. And the Lord had to humble that kind of attitude. And he said, I sent you out there to wander around aimlessly, not taking the promised land, not advancing, not growing. You just stayed right where you were. I did that to humble you, to remind you who you were, and he says, to test them. Now, we look at that and we think about God testing people. You know, we think about God, when we read about that on a regular basis, God testing people, and in the New Testament, we, you know, count it more precious when your faith is tested by trials. And we think about that. We've got to remember that when God says he's testing people to know something, he's not really, we got to realize it's not that God needs to find something out. God's not testing us and saying, "Well, I really wonder what they'll do here. I don't know. I'm not so sure. Well, that's surprising." That's not what God would be like at all. God knows the end from the beginning. He knows exactly what's going on in our heart. More often than not, and in every case, actually, it's not more often than not. In every case, God is testing to reveal to us where we are, to reveal to us where our faith is. You know, we need to know that kind of stuff. Sometimes we have ideas about ourselves, and we have, you know, visions of grandeur at times, thinking about our own spirituality and how far along we are and what we've done. And the Lord allows a test and a trial to come our way to show us where we are, to see how things really are. You know, you feel like you're pretty good. You're going along in your walk, and then all of a sudden you're going to go to Haiti, and people are talking about malaria, and you get tested, and you start thinking about that. Wait a minute, you know. Who am I? And how much faith do I really have in this whole thing? So, I mean, these are good things. These are good things that the Lord allows in our lives. Not so that he can find out about us. He knows all about us. It's so that we can find out about ourselves. And Israel learned some valuable lessons out in the wilderness. Verse 3. So he humbled you. Moses is talking. He humbled you. He allowed you to hunger. He allowed you to hunger, but look at this, and fed you with manna, which you didn't know, nor your fathers know, that he might make you to know that man shall not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. This is so important. Why did he do this? Why was he humbling them? Why was he testing them so they knew where they were? So that they would learn total dependence on God. God's leading us that way. Why do we go through trials? Why are times difficult for us at times? God's desiring that we develop a total dependence on him. We're very self-sufficient creatures. We're clever little beings. We can find our way out of traps and things like that. But God's wanting us not to, live by our own wits and live by our own ability to, gain things, but to live in dependence on him, trusting in him for everything that we have, everything that we do. And there's a great lesson here that, he speaks of. This is, of course, the famous verse that in Matthew chapter 4, verse 4, when Jesus is out in the wilderness being tempted by Satan, and he's been 40 days without eating, and the devil comes to him, and he sees all these rocks on the ground. He says, hey, grab a rock and make yourself some Wonder Bread. And Jesus quotes to him out of Deuteronomy, and he says, no, I'm not going to do that because man doesn't live by bread alone. Reiterating the same lesson that God's trying to get to the Israelites here, that material possessions and the things that we can have here and the material stuff, you know, you can exist on it. Sure, you can exist on bread. In fact, you know, you need bread after a while. You're going to have something to eat in order to sustain you and keep you alive, but that is existing. You can exist on bread. You can exist on material things, but there's a huge difference between existing and living. And that's what God is saying here. There's a big difference between just getting by with the material stuff that you need to live off of. You want to live. You want to live. And we're only going to live as we get into God's word, as we hear his word, as we find his direction, as we find our meaning and purpose in life through understanding who he is, what he's called us to be, and where it is we're going. That's how we live. That's how we find real life. There's a lot of people in this world who exist, and they got lots and lots of bread. They got way more bread than they could ever go through in their lifetime, but they're just existing. They're not living. They don't have life as we understand life. The poorest man on the street, if he knows who he is, he knows who he belongs to, he knows where he's going. Oh man, he's living far better than any man with millions and millions of dollars in his bank account. And that's just the truth of it. And he says, man, God gave us his word so that we could live off of it. We don't live off of bread. We can exist off of it, but we live off of his word. And of course, he's speaking to the Israelites at that time who didn't have a canonized Bible like we have. So it's kind of a stretch for us to take that over and point to this word and say, see, we have to live off of it. But the principle remains the same. It's not an inaccurate thing to do to say that we can live out of this word. How many times do we go to this word and find words of life? The disciples, when all the other disciples were abandoning Jesus after he said, you got to eat my flesh and drink my blood. And everybody thought he was some sort of like, you know, Cannibal Jones trying to freak out on everybody. And so they all leave and Jesus looks at his close disciples and he says, are you guys going to go too? And they said, where are we going to go? You alone have the words of eternal life. It's about getting into this life that we find in this. And that's what this word is supposed to be providing for us, life. The problem is, here we go. It's on a tangent. I can feel it coming. But anyway, the problem is that we as evangelical Christians, a lot of times don't live off of the word. We don't. We fight with the word. We either fight with it in terms of resisting it, or we fight with it by walking around and beating people up with our Bibles and slamming people over the head with what we've got. We get into fights with other churches about the word, and we put up our dukes and we belt out, you know, all our doctrines, and we take them down and we show them who's right and who's wrong and this and that. And that's not what God didn't say. You're going to fight with my word. You're going to be well armed and be able to take everybody out with my word. No, he says you personally are going to be able to live out of this. And that's what we should be doing with the word. When we want to get into the word, we don't want to develop a knowledge of the word just so that we can be really clever at parties, just to be really smart and know how to put somebody down or have that answer that's going to just show that I'm right and you are so wrong. And boy, you know, if you really knew the word like I know the word, well, you'd be something. That's not what God wanted us to do with his word. And unfortunately, that's what we do so often. I mean, we got to be honest about that. We do that all the time. We turn the Bible into a textbook, into a scientific journal. We get all our facts and our theological ducks in a row, and we march around demanding that everybody conform to our interpretation of it. And that's not what God said here. God said, live out of this stuff. take this and look at it and realize that this is the story of life. And it overarches every story that's ever gone on this planet. And it spans the ages, and you're a part of it. And you find your place and your purpose in the midst of this story, and live out of this until I come back for you. That's the way to go to the Word, to find life in it, not just ammunition out of it. Well, anyway, enough of that. Let's see if I can find my notes here. Verse 10. So then God, then he keeps going on. What? Did I say verse? What did I say? No, I think I said verse 4. I think you people are all insane. All right, verse 4 then. Verse 4, Moses is talking. He says, your garments didn't wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. Think about this. Your garments didn't wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that a man, that as a man chastens his son, so the Lord your God chastens you. Therefore, you shall keep the commandments of the Lord your God, to walk in his ways and fear him. For the Lord your God is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of valleys and hills, a land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land in which you'll eat bread without scarcity, in which you'll lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. And when you've eaten and you're full, then you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he's given you. So again, here we see, here's God's motive for obedience as he's talking to them. And look at how, I love how he begins this. He's even saying, you know, I humbled you, I tested you, I sent you out in the wilderness, and you had some rough times out there. But he reminds them, but as you were out there, did you ever lack anything when you're out there? You didn't go hungry when I sent you out there at all. No. And your foot didn't swell. In other words, more literally, you know, your shoes weren't wearing out and your feet weren't getting sore because of it. He kept them, I don't know, I guess supernaturally going with all this stuff. They always had, well, we do know it was supernaturally, that he fed them, gave them manna out there. And then he brings it back to this. And again, we see this picture of God here in the Old Testament, the mean part of the Bible, where God is saying, and I'm kidding when I say that, but I mean, where God is saying, it's a fatherly kind of relationship that I want to have with you. He's revealing it right off the bat here in the Old Testament. He's saying to them, what I'm looking for is a restoration of that familial relationship that I wanted with mankind in the first place. I'm a dad to you. And just like a dad lovingly chastens his son, just like a dad, and you know, Hebrews kind of reiterates this in Hebrews 12, kind of echoes this kind of sentiment, that whom he loves, he chastens. He's going to take care of and discipline and straighten out the ones that he cares about. It's not that God is sitting up there with lightning bolts just waiting for people to get out of line. Ooh, you know, hope he gets out. Ah, there we go. He smacked another one. He's a father. He loves us like a father. As a father, I'm a dad. I know what that's like. I know what it's like to have to try to, you know, wrestle my kids into line and create boundaries for them. And when they were little, you know, I had to, I don't know where you're at on things like that. It's between you and God. But personally, we believed in spanking. And there were times when we had to spank our kids and keep them in line. They had to know there were boundaries there and that there were, he's still crying over it. I can see him on Oprah. Either way. The point is that, you know, it was never out of a desire just because, you know, boy, you know, let's pick on the kids tonight, Robbie. That'd be fun, you know, nothing else to do. No, it's because we cared about them, that we knew that there was a way in which they had to live within this society. There were going to be responsibilities that they'd have. There were boundaries within society that they were going to be facing. And if they didn't learn that in the home, then they were going to be ill-prepared when they got out in the world to be able to deal with these things. So we trained them lovingly, carefully, because we love them. And that's what God is saying to the Israelites here. Man, I love you guys. It's all about my love for you. And I disciplined you like a father would do. And then he tells them, man, you're going to be getting some really great prime property here. This is really great stuff. And no condos, no nothing. It's just going to be beautiful and brooks of water and all kinds of stuff. And he's telling them that this is what they're going to be receiving because of his love for them. And as they experience his love and as they're blessed in the land, see, he's saying there, remember, verse 10, when you've eaten, you're full, you bless the Lord your God for the good land in which he's given you. See, there's the great motive. There's the underlying motive for righteousness. There's the underlying motive for wanting to live in a way that's holy or in harmony with God. It's not a religious thing where we, you know, we got to toe the line or line up in order to please some hierarchical system of religion. No, it's that God has been so good to us. And we look at the stream of life that he's allowed to dwell in our own heart. And we look at how he's rescued us. And we look at how he, well, just even like what we went over last Sunday, look how he laid down his own life for us, to rescue us, to bring us home, sacrificed everything. That elicits a response of love. And that's the motive. You'll never have real righteousness. You'll never have it. There will never be real holiness or righteousness apart from that motive of just wanting to love God because he's loved us so much. Whenever these guys get into legalism and they create these rigid structures of religious behavior that people have to conform to because, well, you know, we're going to, you know, even the whole holiness movement, you know, that we're going to be holy now and the women are going to dress this way and the men are going to do this and we're never going to ever have fun again because, well, clearly God doesn't want that. And it didn't result in holiness. All of those attempts that people have that people do to try to create holiness through structures and tying the old man down will never result in holiness. Holiness, righteousness only comes out of that response of love. And God's even revealing it there. This is your motive for obeying me. This is your motive because I've blessed you so, because I care for you, because you see my love for you. Love me in return. And that's how it's got to be. It'll never work apart from that. Verse 11, Moses is going on, beware that you don't forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments, his judgments, and his statutes, which I command you today. Lest when you've eaten and are full, and you've built beautiful houses and dwell in them, and when your herds and your flocks multiply, and your silver and your gold are multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, when your heart is lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness in which were fiery serpents and scorpions, and thirsty land where there was no water, who brought water for you out of a flinty rock, who fed you in the wilderness with manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you, that he might test you, to do you good in the end. Then you say in your heart, my power and my might and my hand have gained me this wealth. And you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. All right, so again, he's reminding them that when things are going good for them, when everything's going well and you find yourself at ease in this land, be careful, because the temptation is to become prideful. The temptation is to forget that all of this is because what God has done for them and for us. We always have to remember, when we start thinking we're pretty smart and we've got some things together, we always have to remember who it is that brought us to this place, what God has done. We never want to start looking around and at all we claim to have done and say that we've accomplished some great things, or begin to look at ourselves and well up with a little bit of pride, thinking, I've really advanced, I'm really moving on, I've really gained some ground spiritually here, because I'm telling you, we're cruising for a bruise. And when we start doing that, God is not interested in seeing how arrogant we can get in the process of things. And leaders especially have to remember this. It's something that's so important for those who are in leadership. But, you know, churches as a whole need to keep this in mind, to remember who it is that brings them to places. Remember who it is who develops a church or builds a church or causes a church to grow spiritually or even grow numerically. What have we ever done for ourselves? I mean, what do we have? Paul says it in 1 Corinthians 4. What do we have that we haven't been given? What do we have that wasn't a gift that was provided to us? And if it was a gift provided to us, why in the world would we act like as if it wasn't? Why would we act like as if it was something we did? And we got to always remember that. I know that sometimes people get a little bit wigged out at me because I'm maybe, maybe I'm a little too far. Maybe the pendulum swings a little too far in my life. But, you know, I get a little nervous or antsy if people are wanting to be gushy and go on and on about something that they might find that they appreciate about something that I've shared or whatever. I'm telling you, I just get nervous about it because I don't want to fall into this trap. I care about God's glory. I really do. And I'm nervous about my own humanity and where that could go if I let that go. I want to stay humble before him. I don't want to fall into this snare. And you know, you even take a risk at saying something like that, because then it sounds like, I think I'm pretty humble, don't I? So there's no way to win in this situation. Forget it. Forget I said anything. Anyway, you know, he talks about this. He says it's God who gives us the power to get wealth. Now, some have taken that and they build whole doctrines about, you know, how God wants us wealthy, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know that you're going to necessarily be able to derive that kind of a doctrine out of what he's saying here. And in fact, if you really look at the overall context, the whole context is warning. You know, just saying, look, you know, there's a lot of inherent danger to having a lot of wealth. Paul in the New Testament says, godliness and content with contentment is great gain. That's the kind of wealth that we want, contentment. So that whether we abound or whether we're abased, whether we got a lot or whether we got nothing, it doesn't have any effect on us whatsoever. We're fine either way. Yeah, I've got a lot of money. Yeah, I'm okay. I got nothing. Psh, I'm okay. Doesn't matter. Those kind of things don't control me. I'm fixing my eyes on Jesus. He's the one who's leading me through all these things. And the idea of chasing after wealth and building a lot of wealth, man, there's a lot of danger involved in that. And that's what God's warning them. Man, you get a lot of stuff, it's real easy to get your eyes off of me. You know, it's those hard circumstances that drive us to God. It's the tough times that make us remember, man, I need you, God, Mr. Wizard. So anyway, it's just it's one of those things. We have to be careful. Pride is always lurking in the wings to influence us when we've been abundantly blessed. Verse 19. Then it shall be, if you by any means forget the Lord your God and follow other gods and serve them and worship them, I testify against you this day that you shall surely perish. As the nations which the Lord destroys before you, so shall you perish, because you would not be obedient to the voice of the Lord your God. So here God is, again, repeating the same warning that he's not going to tolerate Israel chasing after any other god. He's not going to tolerate them going after lesser lovers. God's not about to share us. He's not interested in sharing his people. And we in the new covenant, as followers of Jesus, we got to remember God's doing the same thing. We look at this as a type, the Israelites going in and conquering the promised land. That promised land dwells right now in our hearts. And God is conquering it from the moment that we believed on Jesus. From the moment we said, yeah, I believe that, I'm following him. Man, an invasion took place and a conquest has been going on. And the mighty king is going through and he's tearing down every little castle. And that's his whole purpose in this, because he's not about to allow any other kingdoms to be dwelling in there. He's going to have the whole thing. He wants it all. And he will fight any bit of resistance that we put up, if we belong to him. And that's the thing to pay attention to. If we really belong to him, then that's going to be happening. But if we go on in our own ways and that never goes unchallenged, then there's some things we need to examine and wonder about in our own lives. But but Moses is you know, saying to Israel that he's going to be a witness against Israel in any attempt at undermining God's rule. So he's warning them that their loyalty has to be to God alone. All right, let's go on into chapter 9, verse 1. He says, "Hear, O Israel." In other words, listen up. You are to cross over the Jordan today and to go in to dispossess nations greater and mightier than yourself, cities great and fortified up to heaven, a people great and tall, the descendants of the Anakim, who you know and of whom you've heard it said, who can stand before the descendants of Anak? Okay, so right off the bat, look at this. He's changing course here just a little bit as he's talking to him. He's saying, okay, he's warning them. You're going to go over into this land and there's a lot of giants over there. There's a lot of, you know, in other words, God is sending Israel. This is fascinating to me. God is sending Israel in to do something that is way too big for them to do. And that's exactly what God is saying to them here. I'm sending you in there and there's no way you can do this. They're just way too big for you. They're bigger than you. They're mightier than you. They're taller than you. They're better looking than you. The whole thing. And he's telling them that. The only way that they're going to ever be able to accomplish this is by trusting in God, is by keeping their faith in God. He's talking about these guys. I mean, idioms even are created over these guys. Little sayings, you know, who can stand up to the, you know, who can defeat those guys? Who can stand up to them? No, everybody runs when they see those guys. They couldn't do this on their own. You know, I love it because God is not hyping Israel here. This would have been a perfect time for Moses, you know, to start passing the offering plate and just say, oh, and you can do it, and it's going to be great, and you're awesome, and you're powerful, and nothing will stand before you. No, God doesn't hype this at all. And Moses is real honest with him. Yeah, you guys, honestly, comparatively, there's no way. This is no contest. You're not going to make it in terms of who these guys are and who you are. God doesn't hype them. He's being very honest about the situation, but he is challenging them to trust him in the process. And that's the thing. I mean, you know, we get so caught up in the idea of hyping ourselves up in Christianity. And, you know, we're going to be a super church. We're going to be super Christians. We're going to overcome and be the overcomers. And we're going to march into Zion and blah, blah, blah. And, well, all that's okay, I guess, except that, sometimes it creates an unrealistic kind of outlook or attitude about the Christian walk. We stop being honest. I mean, that's our whole thing. When we were involved in that whole kind of concept, you know, it was always running around in positive confessions and just, you know, we were marching on into Zion, we were overcomers, we were giant slayers and blah, blah, blah. And after a while, you quit acknowledging the reality of the struggles that you go through in life and the difficulties that you face, and you stop letting your trust be in God, and you start thinking about how great and powerful and mighty we are as Christians. And that's the danger of the whole thing. God didn't want them to go in thinking, yeah, we are Israel, get out of our way. He wanted them to look at themselves realistically and assess who they really are. You guys are small compared to these guys. These guys are big. But you got me on your side. We got God on our side. And God is the one going through us. And if our trust is in him, and if we have our confidence in him that he'll bring us through, then the giants aren't going to overwhelm us. The malaria is not going to get us. It's all going to be fine. God is in control of it. So I just like this about God. You know, he isn't fooling Israel into going somewhere by telling them it's going to be easy. You notice that? He's up front with them in this whole thing. He's not saying, you know, yeah, go on in there. It'll be great. Gabriel, come watch this. He's very honest. He says, no, this is going to be tough. These guys are big, and it's going to be a fight. But I'm with you, and I'll take care of you, and I'll sustain you, and I'll bring you through this. They will be defeated because of my presence with you. Have your confidence in him. And that's the main thing. You know, Jesus didn't candy coat anything when he called for followers. When he said, come and follow me, he didn't say, yeah, you know, take up an easy chair and follow me, and it's going to be great, and life is going to be awesome, and it'll just be better and better as you go. Not at all. Jesus said, no, if you're going to follow me, you know, you're going to take up a cross, and that means you're going to die an agonizing death to self-will, and you're going to follow me. You're going to learn what it is to live in obedience to me, and you're going to be resisted by this world around you, and they're going to hate you. And he told us all these things. He never candy-coated it for us, but he promised us that he'd be with us through it all. He said, I'll be with you the whole time. I'll be with you always. I will never, ever leave you nor forsake you. Those are the promises that he gave us. And so we can overcome. We can face whatever this world wants to dole out, whatever circumstances of life want to throw onto us. We can do that because we know it wasn't going to be easy. My dad used to talk about it. He said, you know, I hate this pie in the sky concept of Christianity. He said, you know, people will say, oh yeah, come to Jesus and you won't have any troubles anymore. And my dad would say, the thing about it is I never even knew I had troubles till I became a Christian and found out what it was to have to live for him. So, you know, and that's just really the way it is. All right, verse 3. Therefore, understand today that the Lord your God is he who goes over before you as a consuming fire. And he will destroy them and bring them down before you. And you shall drive them out and destroy them quickly, as the Lord has said to you. Don't think in your heart after the Lord your God has cast them out before you, saying, because of my righteousness, the Lord's brought me in to possess the land. But it is because of the wickedness of these nations that the Lord is driving them out from before you. It's not because of your righteousness or the uprightness of your heart that you go in to possess their land, but because of the wickedness of the nations that the Lord your God drives them out before you, and that he may fulfill the word which he swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Therefore understand that the Lord your God is not giving you this good land to possess because of your righteousness. For you're a stiff-necked people. All right, you know, again, he's reiterating the concept of victory and pride. He's making it clear that, yeah, you can't do this on your own, but I'm going to go with you and I will destroy them. I'm going to take these guys out. They're going to go out of there, and you got to follow through and be obedient and do what I told you to do and get rid of them all. But then he also warns about pride. When this goes smoothly, don't just start thinking, you know, I'm just so righteous and we got it so together. This is why God's with us. No, that's not it at all. He's pretty blunt with them. No, you've been nothing but trouble. You're a stiff-necked people in reality. But we see that God is indicating that part of this has to do with the judgment of the Canaanite people. Why they're to go in there and destroy them. And we know from archaeological evidence that the Canaanite religion was a very perverse religion. The majority of their religious practices surrounded around the idea of sex and perverse sexual practice with children and different things like that. So there was a reason why God was eradicating that from the land. It was polluting the land. And again, we get this picture of grace. It's not because of righteousness. No, I swore this to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. My love is what's guiding all of this, is what comes across in that. I mean, this is not about how well, and we went over that last time. It's not about our ability to perform. It wasn't about Israel's ability to perform. This is what God does. Verse 7, he says, remember, don't forget how you provoked the Lord your God to wrath in the wilderness from the day that you departed from the land of Egypt until you came to this place. You've been rebellious against the Lord. So he's calling them to remember. You know, he's telling them, in case you start thinking you're pretty righteous and this has all come to you because you've been so good and you've been able to do this so well, just remember, you know, who you are. And that's actually a good thing to keep in mind. It's not that we want to dwell on our mistakes or anything like that, but it is a good remedy for pride to remember who we are and the things that we've allowed to happen in our own lives and what's gone on. The minute we start thinking we got it together and we're, you know, pretty good at this, we need to remember, well, actually, you know, I really wasn't that good at it, was I? Now that I think about it, I'm still trusting in God's grace and his mercy. It's not about me being able to do this so well. 1 Corinthians 10:12 says, him who thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. We've got to be careful about pride in situations like that. So verse 8, Moses goes on. He's going to go ahead and remind them in case they've forgotten. Also in Horeb, Mount Sinai, you provoked the Lord to wrath so that the Lord was angry enough with you to have destroyed you. When I went up into the mountain to receive the tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant which the Lord made with you, then I stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. I neither ate bread or drank water. And the Lord delivered to me two tablets of stone written with the finger of God. And on them were all the words which the Lord had spoken to you on the mountain from the midst of the fire in the day of the assembly. And it came to pass at the end of the 40 days and 40 nights that the Lord gave me two tablets of stone, the tablets of the covenant. Then the Lord said to me, arise, go down quickly from here, for your people whom you brought out of Egypt have acted corruptly, and they've quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them, and they have made themselves a molded image. Furthermore, the Lord spoke to me, saying, I've seen this people, and indeed they are a stiff-necked people, or stubborn people. Let me alone, that I may destroy them and blot out their name from under heaven, and I'll make of you a nation mightier and greater than they. It's clever that Moses is reminding them of this part too. So I turned and came down from the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire, and the two tablets of the covenant were in my two hands, and I looked, and behold, you had sinned against the Lord your God, and you'd made yourselves a molded calf. And you turned aside quickly from the way the Lord had commanded you. Then I took the two tablets and threw them out of my hands and broke them before your eyes. And I fell down before the Lord as at the first. 40 days and 40 nights I neither ate bread nor drank water because of all your sin which you committed in doing wickedly in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. For I was afraid of the anger and the hot displeasure which the Lord was angry with you to destroy you. But the Lord listened to me at that time also. And the Lord was very angry with Aaron and would have destroyed him. So I prayed for Aaron also at the same time. Then I took your sin, the calf which you made, and burned it with fire and crushed it and ground it very small until it was as fine as dust. And I threw that its dust into the brook that descended from the mountain. And so, you know, this is just reiterating everything. We went over this extensively, this whole story, in Exodus chapter 32. And you can go back and look at that. But he's just reminding them how their fathers started off pretty shaky. You know, while Moses was up there getting this revelation from God, they were down having a golden cow party down there and living it up. And so Moses comes down and he breaks the tablets of stone. And he says here, I think this is very interesting, how he was afraid when he saw what they were doing. He came from the presence of a holy God, and he saw the contrast between this holy God and the way these people were behaving and how they were rebelling against him. And it made him afraid. And the word in the Hebrew there is talking about a deep sense of dread or a fear. And you know, I'll tell you, it's something, you know, we got to remember what sin is. While we love grace and we preach grace because the Bible preaches grace, and we glory in God's grace, we still have to remember that sin is serious and sin will have consequences. And if we lose sight of that, You know, sometimes we have a tendency to do that. We have a tendency to just kind of minimize the reality of sin because we've been forgiven so freely. But if we do that, then we're going to lose sight of how great God's grace is. If we minimize sin, Moses was afraid. When he saw the contrast between the righteous God and what these guys were doing down at the base of the mountain, he was scared all of a sudden. He'd been up in the presence of God. He was hanging out there the whole time, and it didn't seem to have this effect on him. But it was there when he saw that sin boldfacedly before God that he suddenly became terrified at this conflict that was there. And he recognized this conflict. And we got to remember that. We don't want to minimize sin. I don't want anyone to ever think that because we talk about God's grace and it's not about our ability to perform, that we're saying by that anything goes. Because we're not saying that. And if you thought that, I'm sorry if I communicated it that way. But it's not the message. When we realize the nature of sin and its destructive force and where it was leading us, this rebellion against God, it just makes grace that much more wonderful. But if we minimize that, then we're not going to care that much about grace. We'll take advantage of it. We won't honor it the way it should be honored. We won't let it rule our lives. It should make a difference in our lives. It should make a difference in our lives that we've been forgiven so freely when we had fallen so far. It should make a difference in our lives and how we choose and the decisions we make and the way we live. It should make a difference in our lives if we recognize the danger and the destructive nature and the seriousness of sin. Well, anyway, we go on here. Verse 22. Also at Taberah and Massa and Kibroth Hattaavah in this place, you provoked the Lord to wrath. Likewise, when the Lord sent you from this other place, saying, go up and possess the land which I've given you. And you rebelled against the commandment of the Lord your God, and you didn't believe him nor obey his voice. You've been rebellious against the Lord from the day that I knew you. You've always been like this. And so you hear Moses, for good measure, he's reminding him of some other things. That was pretty bad what they did to the cow party, but it's been ongoing. He says, since I've ever known you, you've been behaving like this, and it's pretty gnarly. And so they suffered God's displeasure. And remember, the context is warning them to remember that it's not because of their righteousness, to not be filled up with pride because they think they're so great. Verse 25, thus I prostrated myself before the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. I kept prostrating myself before the Lord because the Lord had said he would destroy you. Therefore I prayed to the Lord and said, O Lord God, don't destroy your people and your inheritance whom you have redeemed through your greatness, whom you have brought out of Egypt with a mighty hand. Remember your servants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and don't look on the stubbornness of this people or the wickedness of this sin, lest the land from which you brought us, that is Egypt, should say, because the Lord was not able to bring them to the land that he promised them, and because he hated them, he's brought them out to kill them in the wilderness. Yet they are your people and your inheritance, whom you brought out by your mighty power and your outstretched arm. In chapter 10, at that time, the Lord said to me, hew yourself out two tablets of stone like the first. Come up to me on the mountain. Make yourself an ark of wood. And so we see that the Lord receives that. So, God was ready to toast Israel again once more. Forget this noise. They've rebelled against me. And all the while, he's keeping an eye on Moses to see what Moses would do. And Moses, again, throws himself into a position of prayer, 40 days and 40 nights prostrate before the Lord. And so... that intercession on Israel's behalf changes things for Israel, and God doesn't destroy them. And we see this great sense of Moses' heart for the children of Israel, even after all they do. And again, we covered all of this fully in Exodus chapter 32, but Moses pleads for God's people, and it's really interesting how it is that he pleads. He doesn't do it on any other basis other than that they are God's people. That's what he uses as his argument as to why he shouldn't destroy them, because they're a reflection of God and a reflection of his glory is what he's saying. And there we see the two main priorities in Moses' life were God's people and God's glory. And it's interesting because that's a very important emphasis to keep in mind no matter what we do. I mean, the priority of God's people and God's glory travels all the way through the Word of God. And they go hand in hand. I mean, you can't care about God's glory and not care about people. It just doesn't work that way. We're never going to glorify God if we don't care about people and love people. Just like we can't fully love God without loving people. That's what the New Testament reveals to us and makes clear. This is also consistent with Jesus' summation of the whole law. He said, you know, they're asking what's the greatest commandment. He says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. Those two go hand in hand. They work symbiotically. And that's what Moses is doing here. Moses' intercession for Israel was consistent with the overarching priority of God's love, God loving God and loving one another, this love for humanity as well. I mean, when you think about it, it's a very simple priority. Love God and love people. It's amazing how misconstrued it gets over time and how complicated we can make it. But really, the bottom line, if you're wanting to understand the priority and the purpose even of the church, you come back to that basic tenet. We're going to love God and love people. And that's the bottom line. No other agenda besides that the Bible ever reveals as being legitimate. So anyway, we'll pick up there next time see what God does with Israel after that. So Father, we just thank you for your word. We thank you for what you reveal to us, Lord. I just pray that we can take these things to heart, find these lessons from the Old Testament. It's wonderful, Lord. It's like digging around in something that we thought was a desert and finding all kinds of springs that we can drink from. And we thank you for it, Lord. And I just pray it does have an effect on us. And I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.